William Branley, author of Gods of Eden, writes in his spare time, since his youth, he has always explored controversial topics such as UFOs, aliens, you name it. Gods of Eden is a presentation of well-researched material that Mr. Branley has gathered and compiled. His intent was not to formulate a theory or create a dogmatic view on his findings, but to weave and tie the material together so that you could draw your own summations more objectively. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. William, welcome to the program. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Good. My pleasure. Great book. Tremendous, compelling theories. And I also understand you're working on another book as well right now, aren't you?
Yeah, it's actually finished. It's called Jesus Goes to Hollywood. And what it is, it's a summation of all the different alternative theories about Christ. And what I do is I give each theory its own individual chapter, and I present the main evidence both for and against each theory, and basically let the reader decide what theories might be true and which ones are not true.
Well, make sure you stay in touch with Lisa, our producer, as we get close to Christmas time. I'd like to talk with you about that book, too, all right?
Sure.
All right, Gods of Eden. Tell me a little bit about you, first of all, William. How did you get interested in this?
Well, I was really interested in the problem of war. I wasn't really looking for UFOs, and I thought it'd be interesting to study the subject of who profits from war in general. The normal suspects, of course, are the people who make the weapons, who lend the money so that countries can fight these wars. But what kept coming up was that people individually, you know, the suicide bomber who goes out and blows up, the soldiers who go out and fight, they really don't profit economically. There's something else motivating them. And what I started finding was that there's a common denominator in terms of philosophy behind the people who are really out there. For example, the radical Islamic sects, and throughout history you're going to find a certain level of religious radicalism that propels people to go out and fight. And this I found very interesting. And then I looked for the common denominators behind that, like where do these philosophies begin,
mm-hmm.
and who foments these philosophies. And then you trace those, and I trace these down to these other secretive radical sects that have come along throughout history. And then you look at the origin of these different sects and where do they start. And then you start getting into their own ideas about, well, they're these extraterrestrials who basically are the source of their inspiration, the source of their ideas. And then this became a pattern that came out, then tracing that down all the way back to the ancient Mesopotamian texts and looking at the Sitchin theory about how humanity was created and why it was created, we find, like in the ancient Mesopotamian texts, is that they said that these gods, which of course Sitchin says are the extraterrestrials who have genetically engineered humanity, mm-hmm. that they have... one of the skills they have is to divide and conquer. And so that seemed to be the tool. So then I kind of worked my way back up to the present, kind of analyzing the different wars and the different philosophies that triggered them, like Nazism. And well, anyway, I went back to all these different philosophies, and I kept finding the same pattern, and that's where the theory came out.
You know, I keep telling myself, why is the human race so evil, William? I mean, it just kills always, and I think it will until the end of time. And then it dawned on me that, is it this way? If you believe in life out there, and I do, some of it advanced, some of it not, do you believe that the mentality of these entities, these beings, the physical ones I'm talking about now, have the capability like humans where they kill too, they kill their own, and they're just as evil as we are?
Well, I think so. I mean, one of the chapters that I have in the book is the chapter on the Black Death. The Black Death era was filled with UFO phenomena, and I quote those UFO reports from that period. These lights in the sky were said to be spewing out these gases, and then these gases were causing the deaths that were happening around Europe and Asia about a quarter to half of the population died. And, of course, these were classic UFO reports. And the story about gases, and myths were being reported throughout the Black Death. And people were blaming those things for their deaths, not the rodents, which is the normal theory. I mean, rodents do carry the bubonic plague.
Sure.
But what they were saying, what people were reporting, were that these myths were doing it. So, yes, genocide is definitely within their capacity, at least according to that kind of evidence.
So it sounds like if we were genetically altered, somebody gave us the same trait, huh?
Possibly, yeah. Uh-huh.
I think so, too. Now, when you talked about the Mesopotamian tablets, of course, we're talking about the Sumerian tablets as well. You know, the interpretation of that, the Bible, that something, some entities came down to this planet, whether it was godlike angels, fallen angels, something indeed happened on this planet. Give me your thoughts, William, on what you think that might have been, and what period of time are we talking about?
Well, there's a difference of interpretation. For example, Sitchin believes that these extraterrestrials came down a few hundred thousand years ago, and that was the origin then of our creation stories. I kind of look at the jump between modern Homo sapiens and our immediate predecessor, which happened about 10 to 30,000 years ago, you know, the missing link, so to speak. I think that that's what the creation stories are possibly talking about, is that jump at that point. So my hypothesis is that's when all of this would have started, and that that presence has been here at least since then. Now, if you look at, like, the old Mesopotamian depictions of their gods, they look very much like the gray aliens of today, and these are depictions that go back to, like, 3,000, 4,000 B.C. So it's at least that old. I mean, I'm not an expert in archaeology. I can't tell you for sure what kind of discoveries have been made before that, but it's certainly those types of depictions go back that far, and that's where these tablets and that's where these creation stories also come from.
Yet there are some people, Michael Cremo, for example, who believe that human beings on this planet may have originated way gone back, maybe 1 million, 2 million years ago, maybe even more.
Yeah, I know. It's I don't think we really have the answer to that. All I know is that we have this abrupt jump, and at least that's what archaeologists still seem to believe, even in light of Cremo's discoveries. So I don't know. You know, it's a good question. The timing, when did these things happen, there's a lot of dispute about that, and I really don't know exactly where to put that line. Right now, I'm kind of putting it 10 to 30,000 years ago because that seems to make sense. Not that humanity or some form of Homo sapiens didn't exist well before then. I'm sure it did. But, you know, when you talk about the manipulation of the gene pool, that's when there seemed to be something that happened right then.
You called your book, of course, The Gods of Eden, for obvious reasons. Would it be to you, because it would be to me, William, a little disconcerting, it would be also somewhat upsetting if these extraterrestrials were what humans at the time perceived as gods? You know, I kind of dwell on the thought that maybe a god is something that hasn't come here yet. Yet, the more I begin to learn about what might have happened thousands of years ago on this planet, the more I'm coming up to the same feelings that you have, and that is, whatever came down on this planet was interpreted by those who were here to be gods.
Well, I think that's all it is, and they had really no other word. But also we have to look at the fact that when modern translators translate those old texts, they don't really know what word to put on their word for what they're trying to describe. I mean, they're trying to describe these human-like entities who flew down from the skies and got involved in the civilizations and did all of these things. So they had certain words for those. Now, we look at them as these, well, I mean, when I say we, I should say that a lot of academics look at these as being fictitious entities who are part of a pantheon, and therefore we will go ahead and interpret those words to mean gods. But to them, whatever word they used meant something different. It meant somebody who was very real, very much there in the flesh. It's just that they happen to have another source. And that's really, I kind of look at it more as being members of another race as opposed to being gods in the way we think of gods, you know, supernatural, somehow spiritually superior. I wouldn't put any of those attributes on the entities that they're describing in the civilization stories.
Paint a picture for us, William, if you can. And let's imagine that we are human beings on this planet right as the gods are coming here. Tell us what we're seeing, what's going on, what do we see in the sky, and how does this interaction take place?
Well, I kind of follow, I think Sitchin was brilliant. I think he really looked more at not that we were here and they showed up. His hypothesis was, and this is really based on the creation stories, is they came here. And they needed some workers. And so in order to get these workers, what they did was they went ahead and did this genetic engineering, and voila, here's Homo sapiens to do that work. So I think that the Homo sapiens then always had that relationship with them. It was not as though Homo sapiens was down here kind of minding its own business, and then they show up. So I kind of take that view.
Okay. All right. So under that premise, modern man is created. Tell me then about the theories that we were all taught as kids of Adam and Eve. How did that all come about?
Well, Adam and Eve is really based on an earlier creation story, the Mesopotamian creation story. Adam and Eve are just two symbols. They represent the first Homo sapiens. And the Bible took that from an earlier Mesopotamian creation story, and they created these entities called Adam and Eve. And like I said, we're just symbols. And they talk about how Adam and Eve were designed to be servants, and that's what the Bible says, which reflects the older story that, yeah, Homo sapiens was designed to be a servant or a slave race to do the mining and do the kind of labor that they needed to have done here on Earth. And then the story of Eve being created from the rib of Adam also reflects the idea that the gods were sort of manipulating the bodies genetically and creating basically a race then to perpetuate itself. The fruit that Eve ate from was also just a symbol in the Bible. It wasn't a literal apple or anything like that. It was a symbol of a certain type of knowledge regarding, I believe, spiritual reality. Some people think it had to do with genetics, a lot of different theories about that. But anyway, it was a symbol of a type of knowledge. And that's really how the Adam and Eve story came about. So what you need to do, to really understand the Adam and Eve story, you need to go back earlier to the old Sumerian creation stories.
Now, there are a lot of people who believe in UFOs and extraterrestrials, William, and they believe them to be like the movie E.T., you know, nice, fun-loving creatures. Yet yours takes a different twist, a very chilling, scary twist. How come?
Well, there are two bases for that. First of all, I tend to think that life or intelligent life is really a spiritual reality. I kind of hold the old Gnostic, Essene, Buddhist, well, not quite Buddhist idea, but the idea that we are souls animating bodies. And therefore, we're going to be a very diverse group. Humanity is very, very diverse in terms of our personalities, how we react to life, and so forth. I think that civilization, and certainly the evidence, is that they are the same way. You look at modern UFO abduction reports, the ones that seem to be more credible, you find kind of a diversity of reactions. Some of these ETs, they seem to be very nice. They heal people. People walk away from the experience feeling pretty good. Other ones, they just have this chilling experience. Everything seems very cold to them. They're kind of manipulated, and they're let go. So I think that is one explanation, is that you're dealing, just like humanity is very diverse, that society is also very diverse in terms of the personalities. The only problem is that if you are, in an imprisoned situation, which is what the Essene idea was, the Gnostic idea from, about 1,000 or so years ago, that really Earth is basically a place of imprisonment for spiritual entities. The people who maintain that prison are going to have a certain personality type. Those are the people you're going to be dealing with more. Like, for example, if you were a prisoner in the Nazi concentration camps, the Germans that you dealt with were obviously the nastiest Germans you could possibly deal with, and your perception of them is going to be, oh, my God, these Germans are just a horrible race of people.
Mm-hmm, true.
But in fact, the reality is outside the concentration camps, of course, you're going to find some very nice people. And also in prisons today, most prison guards are very decent people with families and all of that. And they, you know, you'll have doctors come in. But the bottom line is they're still keeping people in there. And sometimes they should be stay there. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have prisons, but I'm just making an analogy to maybe our situation. So I think those two factors together explain why, you know, some people will have this view that, oh, they're all very nice and they're trying to help us, because I think some of them, you know, generally have good intentions. But meanwhile, you have the ones that are, you know, creating these conditions because that's their job to do that. And also part of it can go to the Machiavellian formula. One thing I talk about in The Gods of Eden is Machiavelli's formula that he spells out in The Prince, which I analogize to being the formula that has been used on Earth, because that's what they talk about in the old creation stories. And there, part of the Machiavellian formula is that you stay in the background and you hold yourself out to be kind of the exalted, the nice guy who has the solutions, but meanwhile you're kind of covertly manipulating people into fighting each other. And so I recommend that anybody who's interested in this topic go ahead and read Machiavelli's The Prince, because it's still available, and that is really a very classic formula.
Now, are you saying, though, that these entities are creating most of the problems that have occurred on this planet now?
Well, the theory is that they the major conflicts, the ones that really create the hot wars and the real problems, yeah, that a lot of those you can trace to these ideologies, to these organizations which then foment these ideologies, and which then ultimately trace down to the UFO phenomenon itself, which was very surprising to me when I encountered that. So, yeah, I would say so. This is not to say that people aren't capable of having strife between them. I mean, you know, in our day-to-day life, we get annoyed with each other, we get angry at each other. So, you know, our ability to be angry can be triggered by a lot of different things. We have the psychological capacity, but that can be manipulated because we have that in us that we can be. It can be manipulated on a wide scale.
When we come back after this mid-break, William, I want to ask you what they're doing to manipulate us, to create these horrible moments of chaos in our life, and how do they interact? I wonder what they look like, and I assume you're going to say they look like us. So we'll do that. What about websites? Do you have yours up and running yet?
As we speak, we're trying to get a website up for my new book, JesusGoesToHollywood.com. I'm not sure if it's actually been posted, but maybe sometime tonight it will be. I do have an email address, so if people can't reach me there, feel free to email me. It's at WilliamBramley2004@Yahoo.com. And if the site isn't up and running, anybody who emails me, I'd be happy to email them back as soon as we get that going, and also answer any questions as well.
Okay, stay with us. We'll talk more about your compelling theory in a moment. Right. And welcome to Coast. I'm George Norrie with, of course, our guest tonight, the Gods of Eden author, William Bramley. William, right before the break, I was contemplating asking you this, so I shall now. The chaos that these ETs present, how are they doing it? I mean, are they walking among us now? What do they do to this?
Okay, let me give you a few examples from history, and I think that might clarify what my theory is here. They do it through networks of secret societies and secretive religious sects. And these sects then claim a tie to extraterrestrials, and through that, these philosophies that radicalize people, that cause them to fight over these different ideologies, that's the channel that I see. Okay, for example, we can trace Islam, which is very much in the news today. And you trace Islam to a philosophy that started with Muhammad back centuries ago. And then you look at, okay, well, where did Muhammad get his philosophy, which is now and has been earlier in history triggering some of this violence? Well, he claims he had this vision, and that vision was of these entities who were very similar to other entities attached to the UFO phenomenon, very similar to Christianity earlier.
Right.
Okay. And you're going to, what you're going to find is if you take any really radical sect like that that is having that impact or that has had that impact in history, you are almost invariably going to trace it through these different steps. You'll find that the founder of the philosophy had a contact like that, and those entities are the ones that gave that person the philosophy that then foments the war. Christianity was another one, and I should say apocalyptic Christianity, which was really Apostle Paul, was really, I think, a little bit more than Jesus himself, you know, his vision, which was really on the road to Damascus as he's persecuting Christians. He had that vision, and in the Bible he cites that vision as the source of his particular version of Christianity, and that particular version of Christianity then, of course, justified in some pretty horrible things throughout history. Today, you know, it doesn't as much, certainly, but it did for a few periods in history, like during the Inquisition and the Crusades. So you're going to find that, and one amusing example of this, for example, getting back to Islam, is that the head of the Nation of Islam, which is like the part of the Black Islamic movement here in this country, they're a little bit radical. They're kind of into racial division. Let's create our own black homeland and kind of separate ourselves from the white people. At least that used to be. I can't say I'm in touch with their philosophy that much as much today, but that certainly was their philosophy. Well, he claimed, I think it was Louis Farrakhan, he claimed that he got some of his inspiration by being taken aboard a UFO, and he actually had an interview about this several decades ago. And of course, most people think, oh, he's just being goofy, it's just kind of a silly thing, and it just shows he's just kind of a nutty guy. I take it seriously, because that has been the pattern throughout history, that you have a founder who has this kind of philosophy, and almost invariably you're going to find some connection to the UFO very directly, where they claim that they have gotten that philosophy from those entities. And so that's how I kind of view it. Adolf Hitler is another one. He belonged to these secretive societies in Germany. They claim that they were being guided by what they call the underground, I forget what they call them.
And he was, you know, he was a practitioner of the occult, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, definitely. And what he was part of, these same similar secret organizations with a similar type of ideology. They were sort of apocalyptic, you know, we're going to create this utopian world through genocide. Where did they get their ideas? Well, they claim that these underground supermen were the source of their inspiration through these very secretive organizations that Hitler, it's very well documented, he was a member of them. Now, he said underground, they kind of believed in the universe in sort of an inverse way. They kind of believed that the universe was made out of infinite rock and kind of in reverse. But basically, their concept was a non-earthly intelligent entity or race was the source of their inspiration. So this is the pattern that you keep finding, and this is really the theory of my book, and I tried to document that going through each major war, what was the ideology that drove it, and how does it trace back through these secret societies to the UFO. And it's just stunning, and when I researched the book, I was shocked to keep finding it, because it's very consistent. You almost never find that it isn't there. So anyway, how I got to that.
Did it frighten you when you started stumbling across this, or puzzle you? What was your reaction?
Well, at first I kind of said this is getting kind of ridiculous. I was only looking for people who make weapons. I was looking for bankers who lend money. That's all I was looking for. And I was kind of thinking, okay, those are the people we need to address. Like, my solution would be to let's deprofitize war. Let's make laws that people who manufacture weapons, they cannot make a profit from it, which is probably still a good idea. What caught my, like I said earlier, what really kind of got me going on this other track was that most people who participate do not have that motive. They have some other motive. They're stimulated psychologically and mostly spiritually. It's like you can really trigger people through the sense of their spiritual salvation through the idea that they're somehow endangered spiritually, that seems to override a lot of normal ideas or impulses towards self-preservation. And that's where I kind of also developed some of the theories about how that relates to what's going on here, too.
Are you saying, though, William, that with these theories, that there really aren't, that the religions that believe in what they think they believe, that they're all wrong?
I would say that most religions that are followed by any large number of people have important truths in them. Otherwise, people would not stay with them. So that's why most people will follow those religions and participate. And the most people are well-meaning, well-intended. And so what they do is when they follow the religion, they will follow it in a way that's actually very benign, very positive. But you'll find in these religions these kind of a twist to the truth, where there's a truth, but it's given this twist. And that is then what you can use to radicalize people with, basically. And I really look at apocalyptic belief. It seems like apocalypticism, this idea of the end of the world, the idea that, boy, you better shape up right now or God's going to come do something terrible to you. That seems to be something that, for whatever reason, and I can't really explain it, for some reason, that seems very powerful in radicalizing a lot of people and getting them to do these types of things. So it's really that kind of religion that I really cite as the main problem.
Well, what about the prophetic writings let's say, the Bible, where they talk about Armageddon, the end times, things like that? Are you saying that those prophetic thoughts aren't true, or maybe they were fed to them by extraterrestrials, or they don't exist at all?
Yeah, the prophetic writings, just about every significant prophetic writing traces to that kind of contact. I mean, you look at Ezekiel, he had that kind of message given to him. So, that type of belief is instilled in these, what I would call these ancient abductees. Even modern-day abductees, and this is what's really interesting, a lot of them are given similar ideas. They're given this message about a possible end of the world and people better shape up, and not all of them, but some of them. And some people are kind of given that within an environmental context, I've noticed in some of the reports as well. But that idea, that basic concept, does seem to come from and be taught by these entities. And you look at the actual teachings that they say, you look at Christianity, you look at Islam, and you ask, well, where did they get the teachings of that nature? They say, well, we got it from these entities. So I see that as, it's one way that they can justify some pretty horrible acts. You know, to me, for example, the Book of Revelation, people have been predicting that ever since it was written. And there are certain periods in history where, as far as I'm concerned, it's already been fulfilled, except for one thing. The day of the 1,000 years of peace never followed. But everything else came along. You know, I'll go back to the Black Death era. There you had every element of it. You had the bright lights in the sky, the massive death. There were all these strange radical religious sects that were suddenly arising during that period that were kind of getting people riled up. And, of course, those sects at that time also traced to these mysterious figures. And so as far as I'm concerned, it's really more of a manipulation. But does it ever come true? Every now and again it does. In other words, we do go through a really severe upheaval that really does seem to reflect what's happening. But the promise of them is what is never fulfilled. We never get that nice period afterwards. All we do is we get the next period where the next radical sect will come along, and after a few decades or so, we'll have the next problem again.
And it is true, in every century, they have always said, this is the end times. This is it. It's all over for us.
Right. And it's being said now, and I can't rule out that something horrible isn't going to happen. It may very well happen.
Eventually, though, whoever says it may get it and be right, right?
Well, you would hope so. Well, I wouldn't say you would hope so, but
you would think so.
You would think so, yeah. So, but like I said, I think they people did get it right every now and again. Even like after World War One, that's another period that I cite. That's another apocalyptic era. Here you had this enormous war, nation against nation, horrible death tolls throughout the world, and then you had this massive epidemic, this influenza epidemic, massive disease just wiping out tons of people. And then out of that then grew these new philosophies, like Nazism grew out of that era. And other sects that have so long since disappeared also grew out of that era.
Well, let me see if... Go ahead.
But again, it's like, okay, we have all those elements together. The only thing we didn't get was peace. We just got more war from newer and different factions.
Now, if I understand you then correctly... Are you still saying that these aliens are not among us and that they have merely transposed their thoughts and beliefs to a few, or are they here right now, ships hidden away somewhere?
Oh, they're here simply because people are reporting them. The UFO reports are happening all the time. The media seems to have lost interest at the moment. It seems to blow hot and cold, but certainly they're still being seen. They've been a very persistent presence. So, yeah, I would say they are here. The same patterns that we see are still here. So I would my guess is that it's still going on, exactly what I talked about.
What do you think they look like, William?
Well, the typical little grays. For example, you look at the people who are abducted by the grays. Some of them report that from the grays they get these types of messages. Then you have the earlier in history, I could go back to ancient Sumeria. There you have more of a mix. You do have the little statues and the depictions of the big-eyed kind of entities,
mm-hmm.
but then you also have the more human-like. And I think what seems to have happened over a period of time is that the more human-like sort of vanished a little bit more into the background. I mean, they all kind of went into the background, but then the gray type is the one that is reported more often. So I would say that if it was the more human type that started the technique, then it's the gray type that is continuing the technique.
Do you believe that they helped construct, let's say, the pyramids?
Well, they do talk about, one of the things that the Egyptians talk about is that the plan for the pyramids came from heaven, meaning it came from, an extraterrestrial source. And they were worshiping the gods. The ancient Egyptian societies were worshiping these flying human-like gods. And what's interesting about them is that that worship started in a very literal sense, that if you look back at that religion and go back to its earlier sources, they were actually building houses for them. They would bring food to them. They were saying that they were just living in these homes and being fed like anybody else. At some point in history, what seems to have happened, though, is they decided to go ahead and take more of a back seat. They sort of disappeared from open view, and they became, we still see them, but they're more in the background now. But I don't think that they've ever left. I don't think the presence has ever stopped. At least that's not the evidence that I can see.
Do you believe that world leaders know of their existence?
Not too many, no. I don't, boy, I haven't really studied that. Back.
I mean, like, does George Bush have breakfast with these people?
I
these
doubt
entities?
It. No, I don't think so. What I think happens is, again, people join these groups or they're influenced by the philosophies of these groups. And then, but it's the leaders of those groups that we don't hear as much about. That's where the connection, I think, comes in. As opposed to the leaders that we really see on a day-to-day basis. I have to say I haven't really studied that matter particularly. That's my sense. But like I said in The Gods of Eden, I haven't really researched this actively since I finished the book about a decade ago. I try to keep my finger in the pie, I try to keep up with what's happening, but in terms of in-depth research, I haven't really addressed that. But I don't get that sense that that's what's happening, no.
Why create the chaos on the planet? I mean, what's in it for them?
Well, there are a number of theories that that come up. A, if you go to the ancient Mesopotamian texts that say that humanity was created to be a slave race, then you have basically a motive just to hang on to your possession. okay, maybe we're not being used to mine the minerals anymore, but hey, we're still part of the empire, so to speak. You still got to kind of hang on. You don't want your population there uprising against you, which is really the motive that Machiavelli says that you do this for. Basically, it's just a way to prevent people from kind of rising up against you. And so you just sort of keep them divided and keep them fighting amongst each other, and as long as you do that, you'll be okay. So it's really one theory is simply that we're part of the Commonwealth or the Empire, so to speak, and we just happen to be the lower societal level, and that's how we're basically manipulated. There's another theory, basically, it gets more into the more spiritual ideas.
All right, hold that thought, okay. William. We'll talk about that second theory. Also, I want you to explain what the Brotherhood of the Snake is. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back as this continues with William Bramley, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, William Bramley. William, right before the top of the hour break, we were talking about the two reasons for this. The second, of course, you said was religious. Explain that.
Yeah, this gets really, as if we haven't been into the fringes already here, this really gets even more into it. One thing that I came across was after I wrote The Gods of Eden, a reader sent me the Books of Enoch, and probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with that.
Right.
And I was really pretty flabbergasted because what the guy reports in Book of Enoch, whoever the subject was, he says he seemed to have a classic UFO abduction. He was in his room, these entities show up, they take him up into heaven, they take him to the stars, and he's shown all of these things. And what he was shown was, he says that he went to this area where all the souls of human beings go after they die. In that report, he also talks about seeing this bright light that he communicated with, which seems to be the classic being of light that people have when they have these near-death experiences. But a big part of that that he's describing are these UFOs. Basically, he's describing a lot of UFO phenomena connected to it, that they're coming back and forth. And back in those days, they called basically anything that flew in the sky and hovered like that, they called them clouds. And so he's describing all these clouds that would carry people and that's kind of moving in and out. And so what that came across to me, and then whoever was showing him the site said, well, this is where all the souls of dead people go, and, you know, the bad ones go in this compartment, and the good ones go here. And he said that the people operating this numbered in the ten thousands times ten thousands. Basically, it seemed to be this massive, I would call it a soul processing operation. That seems to be going on that he's describing. And then, like I said, it connects in with the being of light that people see at death, that they report at death. And so, but one thing that he was taught were these sort of apocalyptic ideas when he saw this being of light. And so I kind of tie it into that because and this is not something I developed in Gods of Eden. This is something I developed more in one chapter in Jesus Goes to Hollywood. Is that the ancient Essenes and the Gnostics, they talked about how human bodies and the universe itself are simply prisons for souls. And that is the ultimate purpose of the universe, is to keep souls imprisoned in the universe itself. So it goes way broader than simply some political situation involving these entities and Earth. It gets into what he seems to describe as this massive industry of processing souls, and then they wind up back on Earth, presumably, and exactly, sort of like plowing and replowing souls over and over again. And for that, I kind of look at the reincarnation studies. I think it was Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia. I think he did a very good job researching reincarnation and the proof of that. So that's the second theory, is that it's really part of a much bigger picture like that, as opposed to just something more local and political involving the Earth and whoever these people are.
Of the two, which do you believe, or do you think it's a combination of both of them?
It could very well be a combination. People's motives tend to be very complex. We rarely do anything for one reason. We usually have a variety of reasons for doing the same thing. I would certainly think that maybe this other civilization that we're seeing in our skies apparently probably has the same thing happening.
Do you have any idea where they may have come from?
I don't, and that's one thing I don't even try to speculate on. I mean, some people say, well, they come from other planets. That sounds as good to me as saying they come from other dimensions. When people say they come from other dimensions, I really don't know what's meant by that, so I haven't really been quite able to grasp the concept of that. One thing I kind of look at is that you can seem to do magical things if you have enough of a grasp of technology, if you have enough of a grasp of how the universe works, and you can manipulate it. You can seemingly do things that seem other dimensional, but they could still come from another planet and yet seem interdimensional. That's the best explanation I can come up with. I haven't really studied that part of it in depth. I'm kind of more interested in the social, religious, historical aspect to it.
Have you ruled out time travelers, that maybe they're coming back to do something?
I haven't adopted that thinking, no. I can't say that it's not possible. I just wouldn't see the reason for doing these things. If you're in the future, why come back and do these things? And I kind of go back to, I go back more to the ancient religious text and what they say the motives were. And at least what they say had nothing to do with time travel. It just seemed to be a pretty pedantic use of slave race. But then, you know, like I said, then you get into this other spiritual idea involving Enoch's experience. So time travel, no, I haven't embraced it, but I can't say I can rule it out.
What is the Brotherhood of the Snake, Bill?
That is the a name that basically I use to identify the earliest version of the secret societies that have been at the source of the philosophies that foment the war. If you go back to the earliest text to say how was this brotherhood formed, it was connected to one of the gods, and his symbol was the snake, and this is pre-biblical. So his brotherhood then was the one that had the means to foment the wars. It also created eventually later on in Egypt, you can trace the history of it up to Egypt, where they then put spiritual knowledge in the form of symbols that you couldn't understand, and it kind of made it all very mysterious and mystical. Basically, it kind of wiped out religious knowledge by hiding it behind a series of symbols. And those are then the organizations that, out of which these other factions have grown, these other religious factions over the centuries. So that's really what I call the Brotherhood of the Snake.
These entities that are running around on this planet that might be here, how many think came here? Hundreds? Thousands?
Well, that's a good question. In the old religious texts, they were openly involved. It's not like today where they're sort of in the background and we have people reporting context. Back then, yeah, they were just there. They were sitting on the thrones. They were living in the houses. They were being fed. So I would probably, if you look at how many gods were the earliest Egyptians worshipping, it was, you'd have to get an Egyptian scholar to tell you that, but it was at least in the hundreds or the thousands, so it was quite a few. You know, then at some point in history, those entities sort of fell into the background, and then we just got the UFO phenomenon the way we know it today. So obviously the number of people involved would have decreased substantially, but it's still significant enough where there still seems to be a lot of activity going on.
Do you think there was some confusion over these entities and angels? We talk about falling angels.
Well, the fallen angels, the angels themselves were also the same entities that were connected to the UFOs. They started being called angels instead of gods, but it's the same thing. They were still connected to the bright moving lights in the sky, and they were still traveling on these, what they call the clouds, the circular clouds that travel through the sky. So I think they're just simply the same entities, just given a different name by a different group of people later in history with a different language that got translated differently in our modern translations. Now, the idea of a fallen angel is somebody who fell out of favor with this group, and they wound up down here, and then they started fomenting trouble, and they're the source of it. To me, one explanation for that is that, A, it's sort of a cop-out. You know, it's like one way of saying, hey, it's not all of us doing this. It's that one guy down there who was this bad guy. We threw him down, and he's the one who's down there causing all these wars.
Yeah, don't blame us. Blame that one.
Yeah,
right?
Blame that one. Yeah, it's sort of a scapegoat. So I believe it could be a scapegoat phenomenon. At least that's how it comes across.
In your book, you talk about events, including, you say, the assassination of JFK. You at least used it as a timeline. How come?
Well, the way that fits in, I don't think that there were aliens directly involved in that by any means. The significance to me of the JFK assassination was that out of these secret societies that trace back to the origins that I talked about, one of them was the sect of the assassins. They were back there during the Crusade era. One of the technique that they became famous for was that they would get these lone young men to go out and commit these assassinations. The way they got the men to do that is they would drug them, make them think that they were in heaven, and then they'd be brought back to where they were, and then they would be told, okay, if you go out and commit this assassination for us, sure, you're going to be killed when you do it, but you'll go back to this wonderful thing that you saw. You'll go to heaven.
You had a great life there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so he goes out and does this. He has this misguided religious idea that, yeah, if he goes out and commits this assassination, so he does, and they would become the lone assassin. They'd usually be killed right on the spot, and, of course, they wouldn't go back to where they were. They just found out, well, Jesus, did I make a mistake? But that technique of the lone assassin has continued. It was just a very effective technique. Back then, when the assassin sect was doing it, people knew who was doing it. They didn't keep it a secret because it was one of their weapons of terror that they could use to keep the other rulers in the area under control. But the same technique appears to have continued, except now whoever's doing it, of course, tries to keep it secret. And the evidence that I look at that is that behind most of the lone assassin episodes that we've had, JFK being just one of them, there is conspiracy evidence behind it. And because of that conspiracy evidence, a lot of it, I think, is pretty persuasive. What that tells you is somebody is still using that technique today, and it's just simply carried forward into our modern time.
Well, there's no question about that. What I don't understand is, was it rotten luck for us to get these bad entities here?
If you look at the philosophies of the Gnostics and the Essenes and some of the Greek philosophers from around 500 BC up until around 1 AD or the first century AD, yeah, their belief was that it's rotten luck that not only are we here on Earth, but that we're even in this universe at all. And maybe that's true. I don't really know.
I mean, because surely in this universe, this vast universe, there must be some nice entities out there.
Well, they're right here on Earth. I mean, most human beings are very nice people. We're all under a lot of pressure. We often don't act well at certain times, but the vast majority of people are very decent, and they do their best to basically act in a good way, and most of them do. You know, most people that you see on the street are very good. So, yeah, the good entities do exist. We're surrounded by them every day. And certainly that would be true if there is life elsewhere out there. I would say, yeah, that's going to be true anywhere.
In your research, William, what kind of crafts did they talk about?
You mean the flying crafts?
Mm-hmm.
The most common, they would call them clouds. That's the most common thing that you find, for example, in the Christian Apocrypha. And I cite a lot of that in Jesus Goes to Hollywood in one of the chapters there. They call them clouds, but what you really have to look at is how did they describe them. And they would describe them as, for example, it was very common, they would say they were circular. and they were being guided by angels, and people could be taken up in them. And there's some really amusing stories in some of the Christian Apocrypha about some of the apostles who they would be, the cloud would come, they would get on the cloud, the cloud would kind of have this taxi service, take them somewhere else, do their thing, and then the cloud would come pick them up again and fly them back to where they were. So the circular craft is very common. We also have earlier just what looked like rocket ships, and that's just the smoke and the fire, and something cylindrical and metallic flying through the sky. For example, the initial vision of Ezekiel when he first saw the object, it was like this metallic thing that was spewing smoke and fire, like it sounds like a rocket ship. So those are the two main things that I can see, and I don't have it in Gods of Eden, but it was really interesting because there was an old cave drawing, and I forget where it came from, where there's a circular, looks just like a UFO, it's circular with the two circles, and it's on the back of a cow, and they even show the cow's horns kind of reflecting on the surface of it, as though there had been a crash back in prehistory and some people had picked up the circular thing and put it on the back of a cow, you know. Really amusing. And so that imagery of the circular, shiny craft goes back, I think, as far as we have any kind of records.
Why did you call the book The Gods of Eden?
The Gods of Eden, because the story of the Garden of Eden is based on the earlier Mesopotamian texts. The Mesopotamian text talked about multiple gods having created human beings as opposed to one god. So what happened, though, is that when Judaism was started, what they did was they took these creation stories that involved many gods, and then to conform now with the new belief that there's only one god, they changed those many gods into one. So the point of the title of my book is really to express that originally, there were many gods in Eden according to the original stories, and that's why I use the multiple as opposed to just one god of Eden.
Do you believe that there was an infighting behind these separate races, entities?
You mean the ET races?
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. If you look at the old Sumerian texts, and also you look at some of the texts from India, where they talk about the same kind of flying gods. Oh, yeah, they were backstabbing each other. They were just probably as vicious to each other as they were to, apparently, the Homo sapiens. So I would say so. There's some, I think most of the listeners are probably familiar with those 15th century woodcuts where they have the circular objects flying in the sky, but some are in a field and you see smoke coming out like they've crashed. And one writer suggested that it seemed to suggest that there was a dogfight going on, that they were firing at each other. And that makes sense from a point of view of psychology. I mean, if you look at any oppressor, human oppressor today and in history, sure, they were horrible to the people in their countries, but they were also backstabbing each other. You know, it wasn't as though they were that cohesive. So it seems that way. Is that all I can say?
You couldn't trust them, that's for sure.
No, that's for sure.
Now your theory, what? Because you wrote your book in 1989, was it?
Yeah, that's
right.
Is that
when it was published? So it's been 15 years. What do other people say about it? People in ufology, what are their theories?
Well, the reaction, you know, has been generally very good. There's some people, of course, who don't think that this is going on and don't like my book, and other people do. You know, the other theories are that they're benign, and I think that's probably the most common one, that they're here to help humanity, that, you know.
Well, when are they going to start?
Yeah, please.
You know.
Help us out here. And that's too. That's something that I look at. Is yeah, we've had these promises, and they simply haven't started. Again, on an individual basis, on a case-by-case basis, you will find people who do have positive experiences, and I don't deny those at all. What I'm saying is that simply, as an overall program, it's not as benign as it sounds. And so, yeah, so you're going to find in ufology all these different theories based upon really which witnesses are you taking most seriously? What the historical records are you kind of looking at? For example, Mr. Sitchin, who I respect tremendously, he has a more benign view of the ETs himself. So anyway, that's one of the interesting things about ufology, and I think, frankly, that's one of the things that keeps it healthy, is that it is open to a lot of discussion. It's open to a lot of perspectives. And I don't see that as a negative. I actually see that as a very positive thing.
You know, what I find ironic is Sitchin writes that there was probably a nuclear holocaust between the entities, and or they fought between themselves. And you know what? That same thing may succumb to us.
Exactly, yeah. And part of it, too, is I think it's been the wars have been fomented. But I don't think it'll ever be fomented to the point where we actually wipe ourselves out. At least, I don't think that's the intent.
Well, let's find out when we come back, William, what you think the future holds for all of us. And then at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phones and give you an opportunity to call in as well. And William Brantley with us. William, what's in store then in the future? I mean, will chaos continue that you think is instigated by these kinds of people, the mentality of these beings?
Well, boy, I don't have a crystal ball. I can kind of go back to something that I said back in 89. It was shortly after my book came out. And I was asked essentially the same question. At the time, the Berlin Wall was trying to come down. Communism was one of the factions that I discussed in the book, having similar origins. And it looked like, you know, maybe, A, the theory of the book was wrong, that basically the end of the Cold War was proof that, no, these things weren't going on. But then what I noticed, though, was in the newspaper reports, there were some problems, that there was some war involving Islam. There wasn't much attention paid to it. And I told an audience, well, take a look at that, because if the theory of the book is right, basically communism was not fomenting that much hot war anymore. It had kind of gone stale. The standoff wasn't really creating that much of a threat anymore. I mean, there was always that threat of the nuclear war, but sure, it kind of gotten passe, and it wasn't generating that much really hot war anymore. The Vietnam War was over. And I kind of looked at it and said, well, this is not really, if my model is correct, communism is no longer that effective anymore for creating a high level enough of ongoing strife and threat. And so I kind of predicted at the time that probably Islam, looks like Islam's the next faction with the same origins that's going to be the new threat. Unfortunately, it turned out to be right. Now, maybe it's not right because of my theory. Maybe it's right for totally different reasons. But certainly, you know, somebody following the model that I have could have predicted that. So what I kind of see, I mean, in the real long term, the sun's going to burn out, and one day the universe is going to dissolve. So, yeah, one day it will end. But I don't know that we want to wait all those billions of years. In terms of the more immediate future, if the theory of the book is true, and I should point out, too, I only present it as a theory. I realize that the book cover, when Avon designed it, they said, oh, this is the truth and all that, but inside I'm very careful to say this is a hypothesis. But if it is a hypothesis and it's true, then it seems to be a very, very effective technique. And I don't see right now really any end to it. It just seems to be very effective.
Now, when you came up with this theory, backed up, of course, by some of the work of other people, you mentioned Sitchin, for example, but when you came up with this theory, did you say to yourself, this is preposterous, or did you say, this has got some credence to it?
Well, initially, when I first ran into the UFO, and I kept running into the UFO, initially I ignored it, and I said, well, yeah, I don't want to go there. I wanted to just talk about the arms manufacturers and things like that. And so
this was going to be a non-UFO book then?
Oh, yeah. It was definitely intended to be a non-UFO book. The Gods of Eden as a title didn't come until very near the end when I had to make the decision, well, do I want to really put the UFOs in there? Because initially I wasn't intending to do that. because I thought, well, this is really, really getting pretty extreme here. And the point that I wanted to make really was that we need to deprofitize war. I was really more looking at the human profit from war needed to be eliminated. And I thought a study like that would be productive to show how, you know, all these people make the money from the war. And I do talk about that also in The Gods of Eden. So there's still some discussion in there about that, but it was a very hard decision initially to include the UFOs, because I thought this was just really, really radical, and it is fringe. It's a fringe theory. But I decided, well, you know, this is just keeps coming up. It kept coming up in the research. Every time I traced down one of those trails, it always came up, bump up against the UFO, and there it was. So I decided, okay, I'll just go ahead and publish it. I didn't think anybody was going to read it. I thought I'd, have this little book that maybe a dozen people would read, and that would be it. So, you know, I was kind of pleasantly surprised when it really found a wide readership, and then it got published in paperback. And anyway, that's the history of the book. So, no, I wasn't intending to go there, no.
Has Zechariah Sitchin read the book, do you know?
I think he has. I mean, I had originally asked him for permission to use a couple of his illustrations. He's very kind to have granted me permission to do that. I did send him a copy of the book. I'm not sure if he did or not. I know he got a copy. Whether he read all the way through it, I don't know.
Who did your artwork on the cover?
That was Avon Books. They hired an illustrator to do that. So I had no part of it. It's a nice illustration. It's got the frog and the UFO in the background. I thought they did a nice job on that.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty compelling. I mean, can you imagine what it must have been like in those days to be on this planet in its infancy and have this happening? I mean, that's exciting.
Oh, you mean the creation and the...
Yeah.
I don't know. After doing this, who knows, you know, if we believe in previous lifetimes, who knows, maybe I was there, and I'm happily forgetting about it. The oppression that is described, I don't know. I don't think I would have wanted to be there, but maybe, who knows, maybe I was.
I think it would have been awe-inspiring to see a UFO coming down from the clouds landing on this planet. I mean, it would have been one of the greatest visual sights I think you can see.
Probably. If you look at how they're described in the Bible and in other texts, they're always described as being these awesome things. People were just overwhelmed by how they looked. They were often frightened. I mean, that's one of the most common adjectives used to describe people's reactions to the appearance of the angels and the clouds that they flew in, was that it was so awe-inspiring that people trembled, they were afraid. It must have been quite a sight. But even abductees today, I don't know that they describe them quite the same way. You know, they see the bright light in the sky. I don't know that they describe them with the same awe that they did back then. But maybe that's because we're used to bright lights in the sky now with our own aircraft, and we fly in them ourselves. And so maybe some of that has been taken away by the fact that we're closer to that technology than the people were back thousands of years ago.
This agenda continues, doesn't it, William? Whatever it is.
Well, it seems to. For example, with what's happening today, I work for a living. I don't write for a living, so I don't really have a lot of time to research it. I can only basically offer some avenues of research. If there are any erstwhile researchers out there in the audience, which I hope there are, I think one very interesting thing that somebody could look into is the fact, okay, we're looking at the Al-Qaeda, the whole 9/11 thing. The pattern is exactly according to what I describe in my book. And we know that, for example, the people who were on, most of the people who were on the airplane that hit the Twin Towers, they were actually Saudis, and that they were members of the Wahhabi sect, the kind of the more radical Islamic sect that basically has a home in Saudi Arabia. And I think it was U.S. News and World Report or one of the mainstream magazines had done an investigative report on that particular sect, its connection to the Saudi Arabians, and how they were the ones who basically helped to foment some of this radicalism in the camps, like in Afghanistan, back when the U.S. was involved. You know, they set up these anti-Russian Islamic training areas, and part of what they did was they instilled this level of radicalism in these people so that they would go out and fight the Russians.
Right, right.
Exactly.
And we made monsters.
Absolutely. And it's that sect in Saudi Arabia. And I don't know much about it. You know, I was kind of curious. I went on the website. There doesn't seem to be much known about that sect. And I think if somebody were really, I think you'd probably need to be able to read the languages out there. I don't know that there's that much we can find out about it in the English language. That's the only language I read in, so I, you know, if there's anything in another language, I don't know about it. But, you know, especially if there's somebody who can obtain material and find out, well, who really started that sect? I think we know a little bit about that. It was started just a few centuries ago. It's a fairly recent one. But who was the guy that started this? What was his inspiration for it? Things like that. I'll bet you'll find out some very interesting things. I don't know what it's going to be exactly, but so far the pattern is the same, and I think if you look all the way down, you might find some very interesting things behind that particular sect.
Did you see the very strange video of what could be some kind of an object unidentified on the 9/11 video? Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't. That sounds interesting.
It is different. Now, to me, it looks like it could be a blimp in the distance, way in the back.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of people think it's an object that happened to have been in the area monitoring what might have been going on.
Huh. That'd be interesting. Yeah, the trouble is with a lot of the photographs and the videotape is when you blow it up, it doesn't blow up very well, and it's hard to see what the object really is. I'm not sure if anybody's been able to. Is there a website that has that, do you know, that has an analysis?
Oh, jeez. You might want to, if you just Google search something like that, just put the object video 9/11, things like that, it may come up.
Uh-huh.
It is pretty strange.
Yeah.
Which leads into another question. If they're here, why aren't some of them trying to intervene to make things easier for us?
Well, because if the theory is true, it's that they are part of a social organization. The Earth has a particular position in that social organization. And it's, for example, the same way that we run a prison. I kind of go back to that old Essene idea. We're going to go ahead and run that prison, and the people who are inside, they're going to be treated a certain way. They're going to be treated as prisoners. And we as a society are going to take those actions necessary to make sure they stay prisoners. Probably for good reason in terms of, you know, the people at San Quentin, they should be there. I don't think that we should be here if this is what's going on. I don't think that there's a good reason, if this is happening on Earth, that it should be happening. But it's the same concept. In other words, they have a social structure, and we have a position within it, and we're going to be treated according to where we fit in. And that seems to be where we fit in, and that's how we're always going to be treated as long as we're part of it.
Did you ever guess how many years they might be ahead of us? 100,000? Million?
No, I haven't even tried. There are, you know, technology, of course, we keep progressing. We keep getting better and better at it. It's obvious that if they already had the technology to come here at least 6,000 years ago, maybe tens of thousands of years ago, depending on whose theory we follow, or hundreds of thousands of years ago, or a million years ago, and obviously they've had a lot more time, and they've gotten a lot further ahead. But in terms of putting how many years ahead, I haven't even tried to look into that. Obviously, it's pretty far, but I couldn't put a number on it.
I wonder how they found us.
Yeah, my feeling is that they found, again, going back to the creation stories analyzed by Sitchin, they basically found the planet, or they found the solar system. And we are kind of way on the outskirts, near the edge of this galaxy. And they basically found it. There were some, according to the tablets, there were some things they wanted, like some of the minerals, the gold, the metals at that time. And so, voila, here they create this race to go ahead and do that work for them. And here we are. So how they stumbled across Earth for that purpose a long time ago, just probably just out exploring like anybody else, and this happened to be also one that could sustain life for that purpose. So that's kind of maybe how I would look at it.
Where does this take you next, William? I mean, you've got this other book coming. Is there any kind of similarities between Jesus Goes to Hollywood and the Gods of Eden?
Well, there is. Jesus Goes to Hollywood, it's kind of a lighthearted title. It's Jesus Goes to Hollywood, The Alternative Theories About Christ. And it gets more into all the individual theories about Jesus, not just the UFO-related theory, although I do get into that in the last chapter of the book. I devote quite a bit of time to that. And it gets into some of the more spiritual issues and questions and debates earlier in the book when I talk about the different sects that people have theorized he belonged to. But then I get into also just the more mundane questions, like what color hair did he have? Did he have kids? Things like that, too. So I kind of get into those questions as well.
Do you address whether he was an extraterrestrial?
No. Mother Mary was said to have been impregnated by an angel, and, of course, these were the same angels who flew around in the clouds and had the bright lights and all of that. So, and that ties in, I think, very closely to the Sitchin hypothesis that human beings are, you know, were genetically engineered, and basically they've been involved in that. So I don't say that he was extraterrestrial by any means. He had a human mother, according to the Bible, so and whatever kind of human seed or whatever kind of seed was put into her was probably human, because I don't see anything in any of the apocryphal texts or the other texts that say that he was, they say it was divine, but there's no indication that he had a body that wasn't human. And also I think that ties into a lot of the research like Bud Hopkins has done more recently and David Jacobs, where they see this ongoing program of genetic manipulation using human beings in the a lot of the abduction experiences that people have. And, David Jacobs, he wrote that book, The Threat. Pretty amazing. I mean, I think he presents very good evidence that the program is actually quite extensive.
And they're not here for a good purpose either.
Yeah, they don't seem to be. It's not as though they are, they seem to be saying that they are. That's the message they try to convey to some of their contactees and abductees. But the actual objective evidence, when you really look at the reports, the more credible reports and the more, both from more recent times and more ancient times, I sure don't see that. I see more self-interest, or I see an agenda that really is not healthy, that it's actually very negative in the long term. So anyway, people have different views on that, but that's certainly my point of view. At least that's where I think the evidence stands.
Well, William, all I can say is that it's pretty compelling. Whether it is true or not remains to be seen. I'll tell you what I like throughout all these investigations, the ancient pictures that obviously are UFOs. That fascinates me. You too?
Oh, yeah. It's really a lot of fun to see some of them because they are so obviously, the classic circular discs. The entities that are depicted in ancient Sumeria with the big eyes. Also, I saw some old Celtic pictures like that. There are a lot of those. And, yeah, they're just unmistakably similar to exactly what people are reporting today. So that is what really, I think, lends support to the theory that this is a phenomenon that has been with us ever since recorded history began, and probably even earlier than that.
Well, now it's your turn with phone calls with our guest, William Brambley. So get ready. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back for still another hour of Coast to Coast AM with our guest, William Brambley. And this hour, of course, your phone calls. William, Chernobyl, that nuclear disaster, also had UFOs in the area, according to a number of witnesses. I find that to be strange. Some say that it even helped, it intervened. Have you ever heard anything about this?
No, I haven't. Of course, I know about Chernobyl, but I didn't know that there was a UFO connection to it. There's certainly a lot of evidence that they're very curious. They sort of keep track of what's going on. During World War II, we had the Foo Fighters, the UFOs, flying alongside and observing what was going on with the fighter planes, the reports of UFOs, observing the spaceships as we sent them out there. So, yeah, there's definitely seems to be an ongoing curiosity and monitoring about all kinds of things by the entities. But an actual intervention into to say that there would have been UFOs around Chernobyl, that doesn't surprise me. The story about an intervention to assist, that I don't know. That's an interesting story. I'd be interested in knowing more about that.
Or did they cause the disaster?
That I haven't studied Chernobyl. I wouldn't know if there's a connection there at all. That can't be ruled out either.
No, it can't. Let's go to the phones now. Wildcard line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with William Brantley. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Hi.
This is Rob. I'm up in I'm in North Carolina tonight, driving along, and had a question back in, I think it was the first or second segment you were on. You were talking about Sitchin's, Sitchin's theory, and about how the Anunnaki or whoever actually may have created humans as slaves. I know that's a popular theory, and they left about the time that humans got the knowledge, which is, you know, obviously portrayed in the Bible as Adam and Eve in the apple as knowledge. Now, I've heard the symbol of knowledge could also mean, obviously, carnal knowledge. And my question along that line is, if the Anunnaki did, in fact, manufacture humans, and they didn't want them to have carnal knowledge or be able to procreate, why would they, in the first place, have made them able to do it? And that's my question.
Okay. Yeah, that's a popular theory connected to the Sitchin theory, is that the knowledge that they were not supposed to have is the knowledge of procreation. And that comes from the biblical story that they were naked and they became ashamed of their nakedness. And I think from that, people interpret the knowledge to be some kind of carnal knowledge because they were told, okay, now you got to go cover up and get out of here. I don't think so. What happened was is that slaves back in those days were often naked, and being naked was a sign of being a slave. And so to me, I interpret that to be more of a spiritual knowledge that was withheld because that is what made them slaves. There's a whole spiritual aspect to that story. The Bible basically talks about it as being some kind of spiritual knowledge. And that connects to the fact that they were enslaved spiritually as part of being a slave race here on earth. That's my interpretation. I know what you're talking about. I have also read that interpretation about the carnal knowledge. I don't personally think that that's what it is, but again, it could be.
If they're here on the planet now, William, where do you think they're hiding?
Well, they're hiding basically their presence, their continued possible involvement in what's going on. Whatever the agenda is, I think also, the spiritual understanding, I think, is also being suppressed as well in terms of, the philosophies that drive the war are these apocalyptic philosophies, which sort of tell the people, okay, your spiritual future lies in this coming day of judgment and preparing in the right way for it and doing these things that will cause you to be favored by God, which to me are false teachings. And so to me, those are the things that continue to be hidden, and I think it's part of a long-term pattern that goes back, like I said, back to prehistory or to very early history.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you? This is Lauren in Oregon.
Great, Lauren.
Hi, how are you? William, I just was listening, and you were saying that you did not think that Jesus was an E.T., and I was rather relieved by that. But you said that Mary was approached by an angel, and you implied that that was an E.T. So I'm just from there, I'm just going with that. Was Jesus planted here by E.T.s, and was he trained to give humanity those teachings, his teachings? And if so, what was the purpose behind that? Why would these teachings be given to such a warlike species? It was just to keep us from destroying the planet. And also, you could also extend that question to other divine beings like the Buddha or Krishna. And they also have all taught that we can also attain individual divinity. So is that some sort of clue to the whole thing that's going on? Is that this is a game and we can get out of it at any time if we attain this on our own? I'm just, it's just something I'm throwing out there. So.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about there. And those are a lot of the questions that came up when I was writing the second book, is that was Jesus taught his teachings? To some extent, yes, because if you look at the Bible, of course, it says that he went out into the desert for 40 days and he was approached by the angels and they gave him part of the indoctrination. Now, the question is, what part of his teachings was he given from that possible source, and what other teachings did he teach? I think the story of Jesus is very complex. Personally, he comes across as somebody who had a genuine spiritual message that he wanted to teach people.
And he had great powers, didn't he?
I don't know. You're talking about the healing powers? Yeah, I think he had a lot of healing skill. I don't know whether he had powers to the extent that we would call them magical, but I think his skill was very high in terms of being able to heal. The thing here, though, is that we discovered this thing called the Nag Hammadi Library, which is the library of Gnostic writings in Egypt. Those writings are completely contradictory to the Pauline type of teachings in a lot of ways. In other words, one of the biggest wars that happened right after Jesus left the scene was that Christianity was divided into two camps. They were the Gnostic Christians versus the Pauline Christians. The Pauline Christians were the ones who were teaching more of the risen, physically risen Christ, the apocalypse, all of those things that were tied to the UFO phenomena. That's where Paul says he got his teachings. That's what the UFO contact with Jesus seemed to be, that's what they wanted him to teach. However, early Christians were saying that that's not what Jesus was trying to teach. He was trying to teach something quite the opposite, and that was the more Gnostic idea, that you're a spiritual being, that you're a soul, you need to be liberated, and a lot of the Gnostic teachings actually kind of debunked the whole idea of an apocalypse, or that there has to be this type of thing going on, that the future could be changed in a very different way. And what's the truth of that? Because the Gnostic Christians were just as adamant that that's what Jesus taught as the Pauline Christians were. And that was the biggest theological debate that they had in the first few centuries A.D. The Pauline Christians eventually won. When Constantine converted and he made the Christianity the official religion, they basically burned a lot of the Gnostics at the stake, burned their writings. And one of the only reasons why we even know about their teachings is because we discovered this library, and there were a couple of Christian writers who, in their effort to debunk Gnosticism, told us what they were teaching, and that's how we got to know really about their teachings. So, what I see in Jesus is a very complicated situation where I think he was a genuine spiritual reformer. And he was, I think the weight of the evidence is that he was trying to teach a Gnostic idea, and that he sort of tried to combine that with the Pauline idea, or he sort of yielded to that eventually. Because first he said, no, I'm not the Messiah, don't call me the Messiah, which is the more of the Pauline idea, the Jewish Messiah. Later on, we see him in private saying, yeah, he is, and at his trial saying he is. Like he eventually sort of came around and kind of yielded to it. And to me, that's part of the story of Christianity. I think it was a collision between the two sources, and I think it kind of collided in the person of Jesus.
Well,
I think it makes for a very interesting story.
When he rose again, there are some who say they theorize that he went up in a spaceship.
Yeah, that was after he, you know, they found the empty tomb after the crucifixion, and then suddenly a few days later, here he is saying, "Here I am, I'm still alive." I believe that's just simply evidence he just didn't die on the cross, and they managed to save him before he died. But then after that, yes, there's the ascension where he was basically taken up in the cloud. And to me, that's a typical UFO type of experience. So how does that fit into his teachings? That I don't know. You know, it's a puzzle. Because, like I said, the evidence to me seems to be that he was against some of those types of teachings that those entities were trying to do or trying to encourage people to believe. But anyway, it's an area really worth a lot more research.
Let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, it sure is. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Sarnia, Ontario, Canada.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to first say you're a great talk show host, Larry.
Thanks.
King has nothing on you. My question to William is, and then I'll hang up when I'm done.
Okay.
George asked earlier if UFOs exist, and you said you believe that because people witness them. Well, people also witness angels. So my question is, do you think it's possible that angels and aliens both exist?
Certainly I believe that aliens exist. There's enough evidence to say that they do. In terms of angels, I haven't really studied that literature enough to really say, do they exist? And if what are people seeing when they see angels? One thing that comes to mind, for example, is the experience of Joseph Smith, who started the Book of Mormon. And he says that he was told where these plates were buried that had the text in them by an angel. And that angel was, like, to me, it looked like more of a projected image into his room. And I make the connection between that and the UFO phenomena, which other writers have done as well. Now, of course, now other people say that they have more personal experiences with angels who are not like that. I mean, it's more of a personal contact with some kind of spiritual entity. I'm not really sure what it is that they are seeing. Certainly, spiritual beings, if that's what we are, there are certainly going to be many that are not in the type of bodies that we are, and who knows what they might be doing. So I can't rule out contact with that type of spiritual entity, but I'm not in a position to say what exactly it is that they're experiencing or seeing.
A lot of angelic stories, William. I've picked up many right here on Coast to Coast where some entity comes to the rescue of someone. I mean,
yeah, I hear that too, and I don't doubt that. And again, we call them angels. Maybe what I'm really talking about is how do we define what they're saying? You know, because I get the idea that when people talk about angels, they're sort of talking in the classical biblical idea of what an angel is. But that's not what they're experiencing from what I can read. They're experiencing something different than the angels described in the Bible. The angels described in the Bible are frightening usually. And there's often this high-tech kind of UFO phenomena surrounding those angels. The angels that people report being more intimately involved in their lives are not like that. They seem to be some kind of spiritual entity that may or may not have some kind of body that they're operating through. And so then I just don't know really exactly what that is. I don't doubt that they're having these experiences. And I don't doubt that there is a spiritual entity involved with it. But I don't know how to really put my mind around it, so to speak, simply because I haven't studied it.
Well, all right, let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Run with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Dan at somewhere in Ohio. I got a two-part question.
Sure, go ahead, Dan.
Has he heard about Ron L. Hubbard's teaching his followers that someday this world will be a prison planet and it will house other aliens from other worlds here as a prison, for aliens? And then my second question is that Lucifer in the Bible will be cast down on to the earth and not allowed to go back and forth to heaven. He will be a prisoner, and that would be the sign of the coming judgment of the seven-year tribulation period.
All right, let's take the first one first, if you would, William.
Yeah.
Prison planet.
Yeah, Hubbard started the Scientology religion, and it's basically a Gnostic kind of orientation. It's the same beliefs as the Essenes and the Gnostics, basically, that souls are in bodies, they need to escape, and that the earth is a prison. They're the same idea as the Essenes. So that is the basic foundation of that religion. And what was the second part of it, the question?
So, tribulation, the end.
Yeah, the... again, to me, the apocalyptic theories or the apocalyptic teachings are, I don't necessarily believe that there's going to be an end the way it's taught in the Bible at all. There could very well be a genocide. It could very well be something where, people do get wiped out because it's happened before. And I can't say it can't happen again. And again, like I said, you go back to the Black Death, there's a lot of UFO phenomena connected to that type of event. So to say, it could happen again. But what I'm saying is that you're not going to have that 1,000 years of peace after it happens, because that hasn't been the pattern that's occurred.
All right, we'll be back. We'll finish up with more phone calls with our guest, William Bramley, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, William Bramley, our guest. William, as you did your research, came up with this theory. What startled you more than anything, or I'm not going to say frightened you, but startled you, where you simply said, my gosh, what did I get into here?
I would say that what really startled me the most... I think was the perspective maybe that it put on my personal existence and where do I fit into things. I mean, a lot of conceits that I might have had, I think, had to vanish. And basically I had to change my point of view of really where I fit into things. So I think, there's a personal reaction that you have when you realize, well, hey, wait a minute, this might be something that affects me or that affects where I'm at. So I think that's probably is really the personal impact on me and how I thought of my role in things.
You believe in life after death?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. You look at the near-death studies that have been done, the evidence for reincarnation, and also I read Gary Schwartz's book, The Afterlife Experiments, which
yes.
I think was a really good look.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it was a fascinating book, and I think he's done a really good job in starting that. So I think all those things together just add up to absolutely that there is life after death. And the question is, what happens to us? Where do we go? And can we control where we go and what we do after we die?
And what happens to our soul?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Aloha.
Aloha to you. Yes, it is.
Yeah, I'm out here in Hawaii, and I've been listening to the program. I've been very interested in what William is saying. I think he's an excellent author. He's one of those that are easy to recommend as top in his field. And I suppose I have several questions along the same lines you were just speaking of to offer to Mr. Bramley, and it goes rather like this. I wondered if he'd noticed a UFO technological type progression as time has transpired. As an instance, initially back in the early 40s and 50s when the craft started showing, it's been evident to me that there's such a variety of experiential types, even locational, on terms of the planet itself. And to that difference, originally there was like Adamski's craft, and in fact, a former amateur operator contactee, Dr. Hal Wilcox, was taken to the planet Salo in the Barnard system, and they did truth detectors, and he was on several major media programs at the time and all this, and he only had a tape recorder because at the time, back in 56 through 58, they didn't have the camcorders available for the individuals to use. This is rather new. And as a consequence, we've seen an overwhelming flood of evidence that is verifiable on a certain level. And anyway, I myself, once in 1973, along with perhaps thousands of people in Humboldt County, witnessed a really incredible UFO, rather like the one that former President Carter himself has seen. But this was much closer, and that was quite an event in my life. And after I saw that kind of technology, I realized, you know, that it seemed to me there was a variety of progressions, technologically speaking. And originally, perhaps, when this planet was in its initiating stages of soul awareness, you know, those initially soul controlling type, you know, like, say, if we reincarnated it from people to star people, we would then be offered certain avenues of reason to appreciate time with, at least in the format that I've been offered, for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that very interesting, and I wondered if William had noticed himself in his reports, you know, like my grandmother saw one in 1960.
How about a question before we run out of time here?
Okay, so anyway, has he noticed a progression in the types of UFOs that he's seen reported over the years of his analysis that he's enjoyed?
Okay, there's certain types that seem to be consistent, and that's the circular UFO. That seems to go all the way back, and it's still being seen now. And I think the cylindrical UFO is another one. Those seem to be staples of the phenomenon. But yeah, then you get into you know, the more triangular craft that I think have been seen more recently. Now, maybe they're experimental military craft, I don't know. But I would think, too, that, for example, we develop our aircraft as time goes by, as we progress our aircraft. I mean, there are certain things that always stay the same. We got the wings, but we change the design. We do these things. I don't doubt that that also happens with any extraterrestrial society, that as time goes on, they also change their designs, and also they will build or create craft to meet whatever conditions they need to be used for, you know, like flying through, if you have craft that are limited to flying through Earth's atmosphere, that may look different as opposed to a craft that flies halfway across the universe, depending on the need and what the use is. So I don't know, I'm not sure if I explained if I answered that question at all.
Well, you got pretty darn close. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hello, George William.
Yes.
Pleasure to speak with both of you.
That's okay.
As quick
Thanks.
As I can.
Yep.
I heard William speak of us being bioengineered and also of spirit. And my question is, if we are bioengineered, I mean, how does spirit come about? I mean, what do you think that is? I mean, for example, if I build a table or a lamp, it doesn't contain spirit. And second of all, I think everyone seems to agree that these days that there's a major struggle versus good and evil. And I forget where I heard it, but some ancient text referred to evil as the absence of soul. And I wonder if perhaps that what we have today going on is, you know, those with soul and those without.
Okay, what do you mean? What is a soul? there are a lot of definitions. I think the main religious definition is the soul is the conscious entity that survives the death of the body. And, you know, Buddhism defines it one way, or you know, modern Buddhism, I should say, says that the soul kind of arises out of the workings of the material universe. And then, whereas other religions say, no, the soul is something completely separate from the material universe and exists independently of it. But I think where they meet and where they agree is that it's the consciousness that is the person, it survives the death of the body, and then something, and then it goes somewhere. And different religions have different interpretations of where it goes and what it does afterwards. The Eastern religions say it gets reincarnated, and they often put that in a negative light, like the Jains and some of the Hindus. They say, well, reincarnation is actually harmful to the soul, and you should try to avoid it. The Tibetan Buddhists kind of have a different idea. They say that the soul leaves the body, and it gets all confused. It doesn't know where to go, and it encounters these entities, and eventually it's kind of relieved to get back into the body. The Gnostics and the Essenes, they said, well, the soul gets back into the body, but it really shouldn't. It should be liberated from it. So that's the basic definition of a soul. But then there are different perspectives as to where the soul originally came from, whether it's this timeless thing that exists totally independently of the universe and is essentially timeless. And that was like the Gnostic idea that the Gnostic scriptures put into Jesus' mouth, versus the Buddhist idea where it's sort of intertwined. I should say the modern Buddhist idea. There's a debate about what Buddha actually taught about that, whether he actually also said it was this something outside the universe or whether it was something that arose out of it. But the basic concept is the same. It survives death and it winds up going somewhere and maybe winding up in another body. So anyway, that's how I would define soul in its basic definition.
And I have always believed that the soul world basically came first before the physical.
I think that's a real good bet. Because if it's true that souls exist timelessly, then time had to have started after souls started. I mean, it just follows logically that it did. So I would have to agree with you on that.
East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello to you. Hi.
Hello. My name is Royetta.
Hi, Royetta.
And I'm from Omaha. But what I wanted to ask was, wouldn't our leaders have to be in cohorts with the aliens? Because they're the ones that cover up that there are aliens, I mean, the heads of the government. So wouldn't they all have to be in cohorts with the...
No, I don't think so. And I think you just have to have... you look at who has covered up the UFOs, for example, in this country. And it's the intelligence agencies, like we talked about the Robertson panel that came out and said they're not real, and not only is it not real, but people shouldn't even be talking about it because it's dangerous to talk about, kind of thing. Okay, and so that seems to be the source of the blackout, at least as far as this country goes, and probably it's true of the other countries too, where that happens. See, for example, you know, you look at Jimmy Carter as a president. You think, okay, well, if the presidents are in cahoots, they've reached that level, then they would know about the truth of it. But it seems to me, first of all, Jimmy Carter is just one example. He just openly talked about the UFO experience, and he didn't seem to really quite know what it was. And so I never got a sense that he was sort of part of a cover-up. What happens is that, you know, like, for example, the CIA, it's an independent agency.
I don't think they tell the president what's going on.
Oh, I don't either, and they're not required by law to do it either. And that's one thing. Well, to a certain extent, they are. But what you have to understand about, for example, how it's structured is that you have, for example, you have military reservations. These are areas of land that operate under different laws legally. They're reservations, meaning they operate outside the normal laws, the laws that we operate under, and they get to operate under their own rules. The same thing now, the intelligence services, at least in this country, I'm not sure about it overseas, they operate as, they call them independent agencies. Yes, the president appoints the director and they have the congressional oversight, but they don't have the same requirements that a normal reporting or normal government agency would have in terms of its reporting and its openness. And it was set up that way ostensibly so that presidents couldn't interfere, so that it couldn't be used as a political tool. That was the reason given for why they were given this autonomy and why there are limits to really what they're, you know, how much a president and the Congress are allowed to interfere. The idea was, okay, we set it up this way. And then the same thing, for example, with the central banking system here, was set up the same way. It's set up as an independent agency, ostensibly so that it cannot be politically interfered with and it can operate independently for the welfare of the country. The downside to all of that is that if it then chooses to keep things secret that maybe we wish it wouldn't do, legally, you can't really go in there and do that. So that's why, because of how it's structured, that's why I don't necessarily believe that the people who reach the presidency really are part of that, necessarily part of that cover-up. And I use Jimmy Carter as an example as one person who really generally didn't seem to know and actually talked openly about having a UFO experience at one point.
Let's go to our final caller, Wildcard Line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there. Hello, hello, hello. Go ahead there, Wildcard Line. Hi.
George.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, this is Josh in Alaska.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, question for your guest. I had seen on Discovery that the ancient Semitic had written on a text that some of them were left behind and some were left in outer space to guard the planet. And I was just wondering if your guest could elaborate on that or if he had researched it at all or anything like that.
Any knowledge of that, William?
Are you talking about the Mesopotamian text? Are you talking about, like, the text cited by Sitchin? Or I'm not really sure which text exactly you're talking about.
Well, I just seen it on Discovery. I guess some archaeologists had found a text that the Sumerians had mentioned that half of them that were left on the planet were there, and the other half were left in orbit to guard the planet. And I don't know anything about it. That's just what I had heard on when I had watched the show. So I just wondered if you had heard anything about it or researched it at all or anything like that. So.
No, it's interesting. And you say it was on the Discovery Channel?
Yes. Right.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I'd be real interested to see that.
The Gods of Eden, where do you get the book?
Through the usual channels. It's being published by Avon, so wherever you like to buy books, that's where you can get it.
And it is in paperback form now. Was it ever in hardback?
Yeah, it was. It was originally in hardcover. It was a very small printing originally. I think there were 8,000 hardcovers originally, and then Avon picked it up, and the hardcover went out of print after that.
Good for you. Did you enjoy writing and researching the book, William?
It was certainly interesting, and it was very grueling work. It was actually exhausting to work on it. So, yeah, this kind of research really eats up the time, and you have to be ready to do it. So I'm not sure I want to do too much of it. Even this Jesus book turned out to be a lot more work than I thought. So
it's a lot of work.
It really is.
I'm working on one now, but I'll tell you about that later. William, thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks very much.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM.